Hey, podcast listeners, Michael Shelley here. Today is an encore presentation. It's an interview I did with Bones Howe, October 20th, 2007. I think this was live. I can't even remember. I'm pretty sure it was live. What can I tell you about Bones Howe? I mean, he created the California Wrecking Crew sound in a lot of ways. So many of the records associated with that time he worked on in some way, from Jan and Dean to the Mamas and the Papas to the Fifth Dimension to it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on. The Association, all those records really have something in common, and I really do think it's Bones Howe. You know, he's not a performer. He's an engineer, producer, and so maybe he's not as dynamic as a guest as some of the guests I have that are performers. But this is so interesting. 2007, where has the time gone? I mean, wow, my mind is going nuts. Almost 10 years ago, right? He's still with us, though. He's in his 80s. The records are fantastic. And somebody emailed me and said, will you rerun this Bones Howe interview? And I said, yeah, I haven't myself listened to it in, you know, since then. So let's hear it. Interesting guy, great guests. As a sideline, we tried to do a part two. This one we did tape in advance, and the machine froze, and it disappeared. And that was the day that I started using two machines whenever possible to tape a conversation. So that never aired, and it's too bad because we don't talk about the later half of his career, work with Tom Waits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, you want to email me, it's michaels@wfmu.org, and that's it. Here is my conversation with the great Bones Howe. Yeah, there's the Fifth Dimension, sounding particularly good in headphones, I'd like to add. And that record was produced by Bones Howe, and Bones joins us on the telephone. Bones, welcome to WFMU.
Thank you very much, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got to say, even though I had to drive my wife to the airport at about 3:30 in the morning, I'm still doing great.
That's not a pleasant drive. I've done that drive a couple of times.
Yeah. I think I should interview you, though, although we can talk about my wife. She's fantastic.
I'm happy to hear that.
she's really great. You were born in Minneapolis, but grew up in Florida, went to high school in Florida.
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yeah, where it's cold. When did you get interested in music?
I think I was probably, it was when I was just tall enough to wind up a Victrola phonograph.
Hmm.
And, you know, there was only radio when I was growing up. I grew up in the 30s and 40s, and there was no television. And so all of our entertainment came into the house either by radio or by the phonograph, which was a wind-up phonograph, a Victrola that you wound up with a crank, and you had steel or cactus needles. And when I was finally tall enough that I could reach up and put the needle in the groove, that's really, I think, when my first interest in music surfaced, I guess.
They're really cactus needles. I never heard about that.
There were cactus needles. Yeah, they were quieter. They didn't make as much scratchy sound.
Amazing. You started to play the drums when?
In high school. I was it was around 1948. I graduated high school in 51. Some friends of mine were in a band, and they were older than I was, and I just there was a bebop band. John Edmondson had a little quintet, and that was a bebop band, but they did play for dances. And then there was this six-piece band that played for dances in high school, all high school students, and the band was called the Solid Six. But I was more interested in the bebop band, and I always said, you know, someday I'm going to play with this band. And two friends of mine and myself started a trio, piano trio, and I just learned by listening, and I was self-taught. I learned by listening, and I did play with John Edmondson, and I did play with the Solid Six, and I went off to college. The Korean War was raging, and I didn't want to carry a rifle, so I went to engineering school. I was always interested in radio, and and obviously in music and phonographs and that sort of thing, electronics. So I went to Georgia Tech to study electronics and communications.
And how'd you get from there out to Los Angeles?
Well, what happened was I arrived at college and got rushed by a few fraternities, and one night there was a jam session and there wasn't anybody sitting in the drums, so I sat down and started playing, and there was some guy there that had a band and came over to me and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, you know, my real name is Dayton, like the city on high. My name is Dayton now, and I'm a student at Georgia Tech." And he said, "Well, do you have any drums?" And I said, "No, my drums are at home." And he said, "Well, how quick could you get them?" In those days, the quickest way you could get something was by Railway Express. So I had my mom put them on the Railway Express, and I can have them by next week. He said, "Well, if you can have them by Saturday night, I've got a job for you." And that's how it all began. And I played, by the time I was a senior in college, I was playing six nights a week with various bands and stuff. And in the process of that, I met a drummer from California named Shelly Mann, who was playing with a Stan Kenton band, and he said to me, Fort McPherson had in Atlanta had a great jazz band and a dance band there, and he said, "Well, you must be at Fort McPherson. Are you in the Army?" And I said, "No, I'm going to school." He said, "Where are you going to school?" I said, "Georgia Tech." He said, "What are you studying?" I said, "Electronics and Communications." And he looked at me for a minute, and he said, "A musician studying electronics?" He said, "You know what you should do? You should come to California and get into recording, because there aren't any engineers in recording studios that know what a rhythm section is supposed to sound like." And I graduated, and drove to California.
Wow, because Shelly Mann told you to.
With my drums and my clothes, and that was it,
And you got a job pretty quickly?
It took me about a month. I got a job at an independent recording studio called Radio Recorders on Santa Monica Boulevard. Actually, the building still exists. The studio's still there. And I started as an apprentice. They couldn't believe that a guy with an engineering degree would go to work at a recording studio as an apprentice, but that's what I wanted to do. And in those days, there were a lot of jazz recordings made in that studio. Pacific Jazz recorded there, and there were some New York labels that recorded. And RCA did most of their recording there, so there was Shorty Rogers, and Norman Granz did a lot of his Verve recordings there. So there was a lot of jazz being recorded in those studios. They were really wonderful studios. And it was mono in those days. There was no stereo.
Wow.
I was there for the beginnings of stereo and helped to design a network that, the one time I used my engineering education, I helped to design a network so we could put a phantom center between two tracks. But other than that, it was all about the music for me. It was always about the music.
Do you remember the first session that you got to actually engineer?
Yes, I do.
What was that?
Dave Pell, who was a tenor saxophone player in the Les Brown band, and then had settled in North Hollywood, which is near near Hollywood. It's over in the valley. Had seen me working in the studios as a recordist and asked me if I was felt I was ready to do a session as a mixer, and I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he was involved with a new label called Topps Records, which sold their product in the thrifty drugstores for $1.99. And he said, "Well, I'm going to record a Dixieland band, so I want you to be the engineer." And it took him about 2 hours of arguing with the management to get them to agree to let me do it. And finally, they just said, "Well, look, if it all goes wrong, it's your fault, not ours." So I recorded, there was a bass player named Morty Korb, and there was just, a bunch of studio guys that lived in the Los Angeles area that had been Dixieland players, and we did this wonderful little Dixieland record, that was my first, and that, of course, really set things loose, because from then on people knew I was mixing, and I did, I recorded Bud Shank and Marty Page's Deck, I just recorded. There was a label called Mode Records that had been an offshoot of Bethlehem in New York, Bethlehem Records in New York, and I did a whole series of those with a wonderful guy named Red Clyde, who had moved to California and was recording all the West Coast guys. It just kind of went on from there. I started doing sessions with Nessie Erdogan from Atlantic Records, and I did the first two Ornette Coleman albums on Atlantic, and then I did an album with Nesui, with Red Mitchell and Harold Land, and by that time I was working very closely with Nesui, he sent me the album, and without saying anything, he just sent me the album, and the album came in the mail, and I opened it up, and I looked at it, and I turned it over, and I looked on the back, and it said, produced by Nestle Erdingen and Bones Howe. And it was the first time I'd had a production credit. I mean, I'd had my name on the back of albums as an engineer, but never as a producer. And that was sort of the, you know, the moment when I said, gee, maybe I can do this too.
I was going to ask you, how did you get into producing? How did you get from these heavy, heavy jazz sessions to these heavy, heavy pop record sessions?
Well, what happened was, you know, in the 60s, sort of going into the middle 60s, you know, when surf was rising, jazz was falling. You know, out here in the West Coast, it was beginning to disappear. You know, Shorty Rogers couldn't get a gig. You know, it was all that stuff that had been going on at the Lighthouse and all up and down Hollywood Boulevard, Jazz City, and The Hague, and all these other places, just began to disappear. And guys began to take jobs at the Tonight Show band and whatever they could get work. You know, it was the whole thing was beginning to change. And of course, the Beatles stuck the final dagger in all of that, and the whole music business changed from what was pop when I got into it to what became pop from the 60s onward. But
in that time from the, you know, when you first got there to the very early 60s, the pre-Beatles 60s, you were recording all kinds of people walking through that door.
Oh, absolutely. I was recording everything. You know, I was
Frank
recording,
Sinatra?
Armed Forces Radio Service transcriptions, you know, with these little seven-piece bands that were doing dance music. I was recording anything, you know, Sir Walter Raleigh pipe tobacco, anything that came through the door. People said to me, oh, you were so lucky you got to work on those. I said, you know what? I got up and went to work every day, and when I got there, I didn't know what I was going to do until I got there.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
You know, it's a job. You do it 5 days a week or 6 days a week, and you know, if you go show up every day, so you're going to get thrown into some things. And you know, I worked with Elvis. I did all kinds of different. I did a lot of pop music, but my real love was jazz. But what happened was, the music in L.A. began to turn into the R&B. You know, the first pop music was sort of, you know, what was called rock-tinged R&B. You know, get out of that band, rattle those pots and pans. You know, all that stuff was happening then. So shake, rattle, and roll. You know, that kind of R&B. And, of course, a lot of the guys that had played jazz were now, particularly the black guys, were playing this new R&B. And I started playing, I started going to those sessions. And then people would say, well, you know, would you do this session for me? And so I would engineer for them. I was still gigging in those days. You know, I played with a little band, you know, at the El Monte Legion Stadium. You know, I was doing everything I could do to, you know, to keep moving. You know, I was meeting myself coming in and out the door.
Tell me about working with Sinatra.
Well, I moved to United Recording. I spent 5 years at radio, and then I moved over to United Recording. Bill Putnam, who had Universal Recorders in Chicago, had built a studio on Sunset Boulevard called United Recording. Later, he bought Western, and it became the famous United and Western, where all those big hits were cut in the 60s. And Bill had always done Frank's sessions at Universal Recording in Chicago. And when he moved out here, Frank had started a label called Reprise and was doing his sessions at United. And one night, Bill had a terrible accident. It was raining. He went outside. He slipped and fell and hit his head on the sidewalk. And he had scheduled me to work with him on as his recordist. And we carried him up and put him up in his office. And he just said to Frank, "Look, Bones will do the sessions. He's a really good mixer, and he'll." So that was the first time I worked with Frank. And Neil Hefti was a producer. It was a real, you know,
he was
Billy
a volatile.
May was the arranger, and Frank was great. You know, his thing was he would give the band. He would usually show up an hour late to give the band a chance to run all the charts down to find where the, you know, if there were bad notes, and let the arranger, you know, figure the kinks out, that whatever they were. So he was real loose in the studio. For him, it was like, you know, being on stage, and he would fool around with, you know, kidded around with the musicians, but when it came time to record, he was dead serious. And he'd give you four or five takes, and he'd listen back and say, if that isn't it, I don't know what it is, and that would be it, and you'd go on to the next song. So, and remember, we were recording simultaneous. I think by those days we were recording in three tracks, so there was no... the mixes were very, very simple. You could play a mix back into the studio off a three-track.
Mm. So a volatile guy, but you really just saw a professional at work.
Yeah, I liked him a lot. And of course, when the fifth, when I was producing The Fifth Dimension, and they were opening for Frank at Caesar's Palace, I saw a lot of him.
He
was a good guy. I liked him a lot. He was a guy who was friends with the musicians and hated the management. That was his, because he started on the bottom, you know. He was on the road with the Dorsey Band. You know, he paid his dues long before. He wasn't a guy that kind of grew up in a recording studio. He grew up on the road with bands.
All right. First time you saw Elvis Presley was when?
1957, when Elvis came to California to record the first time. I was still working as a recordist, sometimes as a mixer, but mostly as a recordist. And there was a mixer named Thorne Nogar, who became very close with Elvis, became the guy that Elvis wanted to do all his sessions, was his mixer. And I was working with Thorny and as his recordist, and Elvis came into the studio with his guys. You know, they had that stretch limo that they drove out from Memphis, and we did one song at a time. You know, the Auerbach brothers had this Hill and Range music, and they published all of Elvis's songs, and they showed up at the studio with demos, and I'd play the demos out in the studio, and Elvis would say yay or nay, and then he would learn the song right off the demo. I mean, he came to the studio just ready to, whatever was good he liked and wanted to record, he recorded, and whatever he didn't like got thrown in the trash.
Yeah, amazing way to work. And
I always said he was the first self-produced rock star. Because he chose the songs. He worked out the arrangements with the guys. He chose what the good takes were. And, you know, the guys from RCA that came and sat in the booth were nice guys and all that, but everything pretty much bent to whatever Elvis wanted to do.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's too bad he didn't focus on that all a little bit more on that end of things.
Well, he just he liked to participate in the creation part, but then when it came to performing, and what he really loved to do was perform. And so when it came to when the band started playing, I mean, he forgot all about that. He just wanted to sing and, you know, have a good time.
Yeah, you a lot of big hits, a lot of big records started coming out of L.A. right about that time. Some of your early hits with the Rounders, we just heard from them, Out of Limits, the Marquettes, and all the Jan and Dean records. And when I say all the Jan and Dean records, they were making three or four records a year.
Yeah, Jan was one of those guys. Jan's life was, you know, being in the studio, and he would come by my house on Saturday afternoon and say, I want to remix. I've been listening all week. I want to remix that. You know, come down to the studio and we'll remix. I mean, it was like there weren't, the days of the week were all the same for him. And I was married and had a family by then. You know, I'd like to have my weekends to detox, you know, get away from the studio a little bit. But he was, you know, let's go. Let's do this. Let's do that. You know, I'd work with him until the middle of the night, and then I'd go to the cutting room and I'd cut a 45 acetate reference for him, and we'd drive up to Hollywood Boulevard, and he'd go into KFWB, and Roger Christian would play it on the radio so we could hear it on the radio. I mean, the days were so completely different then.
That's crazy. That's the beginning of the time when you're starting to work with the guys who are known as the Wrecking Crew and songwriters who end up playing a big part in lots of different groups that you work with. At that time, you're working with, I guess, Gary Lewis, folks like that, and you start to produce the group called the Turtles.
Yeah, what happened was there was a group called the Crossfires that were performing down in Redondo Beach at a little club down there, and they were a surf band. And two guys that had been promotion guys for A&M Records said they were going to start their own label, and they found this group, and they came to me and said, Herb Alpert said that you're going to be the next big producer, told us that you're going to be the next big producer. I'd worked with Herb a few times in Hollywood, so if you would be interested in producing this group, we would love for you to do that, take a shot at it. And so I said, well, I got to hear them first. Went down to South Bay with them and the club, and these guys were rehearsing. It was in the afternoon. They were rehearsing, and they played some songs that they had written, and they played a couple of surf songs. And then they played this version of Bob Dylan's tune, It Ain't Me, Babe, which Dylan had only recorded just, you know, voice and acoustic guitar and mouth harp. So he, they played this tune, and I went, that's the song that's a hit. Yeah, I'll do this, because that's a song that's a hit. And
it was.
So we went back, you know, we did a session in the studio, and we did that tune, and... you know, I'd had so many years in the studio by then, and really had my own ideas about what I would do if I were producing. And so I got a top 10 record the first time out.
Yeah, and it's a great record. Did someone say, listen, this...
By the way, they were called the Crossfires when... they were called the Crossfires when I met them. They changed their name to the Turtles right before they put the record
out. It seems like they also changed to a folk rock band, or...
Well, that was really what it was. That was the beginning of folk rock. I mean, Dylan was just starting to go electric. You know, there were all these other things that were happening then that were beginning... Music was, again, beginning to change.
Was that
something... Love and Spoonful, which was a good time. I mean, you know, there was this whole...
Was that something the band wanted or the record company wanted?
The record company wanted a hit.
They didn't care what
they didn't
was.
Care.
Right.
They wanted a hit.
And
they got one.
There's a little bit of controversy. Does the Turtles play on all of, like, the You Baby album?
They did. They played on all the things that I did with them. They played on all the tracks,
Okay.
The band had changed by the time they got to Happy Together, and so that band was a little bit more sophisticated, I should say, a little bit less, street level. There were some better musicians in the band by then. So, and I think the record shows it.
Hmm. You're working with the Mamas and the Papas, back to engineering, but some giant hits, 1966 through 68.
Well, Lou and I got together. You know, I met Lou when he and Herb Alpert were hanging around the halls of Radio Recorders, and Herbie had his horn in a brown paper bag. I had engineered a couple of sessions for Herb, for Dante and the Evergreens. He was arranging. Herb was doing anything he could do in those days. And Herb and Lou had done Jan and Ernie. I mean, they'd done all these, you know, these lightweight, sort of recording acts that had been on the charts, but not really done anything big. And Lou, you know, during the period that I was making all those jazz records, Lou, whenever he would work in the studio, said, "Well, don't give me bones because he's the jazz guy." When I got over to United and made a few pop recordings, he called me up one day and he said, "I'm going to do an Everly Brothers record and I want you to do it with me." And the song is called "Don't Ask Me to Be Friends," and we recorded in the studio. And of course, the two black guys got in a fight in the studio, but we got the record made. And
Who got in a fight?
Well, the Everlys, they weren't really on good terms with one another in those days. I mean, Phil seemed to be, okay, but, they just weren't on really good terms, and they got into a battle about who was going to sing what in the bridge, and, mm-hmm. apparently. But Lou got the session done, which was the important thing. He was still working for Nevins Kirshner Music then, which became Screen Gems. And this was really the first record that he had produced as a solo producer. And he called me up, and in those days, you took an acetate ref, 45 ref home. Called me up after played the ref, and he said, "That's a perfect mix." He said, "I want you to do my sessions." And when he started Dunhill Records, I had become an independent engineer, and he called me up and said, "I want you to do all the Dunhill sessions. I want you to be my engineer." Well, that's how it all kind of began. I just I was working for Lou all the time, and we were recording. We recorded Eve of Destruction with McGuire, and then McGuire was going to do an album, and one night we're all assembling in the studio to do a couple of tracks for McGuire's album, and these four scruffy kids show up with a guitar, and Barry says, this is John Phillips. He wrote, California Dreamin', you should hear these guys sing. They sing really well. And so Lou and I went in the back room and listened to them sing, and I mean, they were amazing, it was, what became the Mamas and Papas, and the four kids and a guitar, and Lou said, "What do you think?" And I said, "If you don't take them, I will." he got them away from Capitol Records. They ended up on Dunhill, and of course, the rest is rock history. The Bathtub album was a huge album, and. Yeah. And off they went. I did that album, the next album, which I call the Window album. I go by the photographs on the front. The first one's a bathtub album, second is a window album. And I started the third album with Lou, which is a swimming pool record. And then I decided in 1967 that I was going to spend my... By then I'd had a few records on the charts, and I decided that I was going to just stop engineering for other people, and I was just going to do production from that point on. And so I never finished that record with Lou. Somebody else finished it.
Just real quickly, tell me a little bit about... I mean, that's the beginning of what of the whole Wrecking Crew sound. One thing that, that sort of strikes me talking to you is the early style of recording where you've got two or maybe three tracks, and then you move to the 60s style of recording where it's still... a limited number of tracks, but there's it's a little more technologically advanced. It sounds better, and it's a, such a perfect time. Those 60s records have such a great sound to them because later the 70s come in, and everyone's recording to 24 and 48 tracks, and it really just changed the way sonically everything was done. And, you know, I just get the feeling that during a Mama's the Papa session, there's no let's hit the bass drum for a half hour. And you
know, no, I never did that. I mean, it took me... you know, some guy from a heavy metal band once called me up later, much later when I was working at Columbia Pictures, called me up and said, you know, I got to know how you got that drum sound, and he named a record. And I said, the way you get that drum sound is that you're in Studio 3 at Western Recorders, and you've got two guitars, a piano, an electronic keyboard, bass and drums all in the room together. And I said, and then you, it's just where you put the microphones, and the mics are all open, and it's where you put the microphones. I said, you know, that sound is the sound that you get from not recording everything individually. That's the sound you get from having people play together in the studio, but which is really what I did best, because I came out of jazz records. You know, in jazz records, as Zoot Sims once beautifully described the way you make a jazz record, he said, you turn on your mic, you turn on your tape, and you turn on your tape, you turn on your mic, and you get what you get, and that's it. And that's really the way you make a jazz record. You get what you get, and that's it.
Well, the beautiful thing about these 60s pop records the, recorded in Los Angeles is you have that very live under part, and then there's some sweetening or some vocal doubling or something that happens on top of it that make it really interesting and you know, ready for repeat listening and really just poppy and emphasize the most, you know, the hooks.
Well, the basic thing about this, Michael, is that in those days you made all your decision, your music decisions in the studio, because you didn't have the opportunity to you didn't have the luxury of endless tracks to, you know, to be confused for 3 years trying to figure out what you're going to have on your record. You made the decisions right then and there because you only had a limited number of tracks. I mean, even with 16 or 24, you had a limited number of tracks. And you had to pretty much make your decisions right then and there, and especially with three-track. So the overdubs and, you know, the Windy was on four-track, and I made the decisions about all those sounds that are on that record I made before I did, you know, that last overdub. So that's a record. You're done, and that's the record. And you either love it or you hate it. But in most cases, they work out if you plan ahead. Yeah. And that's because I came out of the days when you did everything live.
You talk about you made the decision to just produce records, and the Association's one of the groups you got a hold of right away. And like you said, Windy, a number one hit, Never My Love, also big hit for them. A strange group, you know, everybody sort of sings, and it's just what did you do? You looked at them and said, okay, here's what we're going to do.
When they asked me to come, when they asked me to meet with them, I met with them, and I said, okay, look, you guys, we'll agree on the material we're going to record. I'll bring you songs, you bring me songs, and we'll decide. And if either one of us doesn't want to do it, then we won't do it. If all of us love it and want to do it, we'll do it. And that's how we'll choose the material. I said, the one thing that you guys aren't going to do is you're not going to play on the record, because they'd made two records by then and two albums by then. On Cherish and Mary, Along Comes Mary, they had not played on those records. And then on the second record they made, Pangora's Golden Heebie-Jeebies or whatever it was called, they had played on that, and it was more or less self-produced, and it had been a terrible disappointment. So I just said, these are the ground rules. The guys are going to play on it. In the end, they wouldn't let me put I call them the guys. They were what ended up being called the Wrecking Crew. And they wouldn't put their names on the album because they didn't want their fans to think that they hadn't played on the record. Mm. But But it didn't matter because it's pop music, you know. It goes out. I don't think anybody ever turns a record over, you know, to look at the back of an album. But
when you heard "Windy," did you go, "Okay, this
it
is"?
It was a demo that I heard. They gave me a roll of demos by a gal named Ruth Ann Friedman, who was a sort of a folk, you know, guitar vocal, you know, folk artist, acoustic guitar. You know, she's one of those acoustic guitar singers, and it was on a tape with I don't know, maybe 10 other songs or 12 other songs. And I went through the reel of tape, and I came to this song, and it was in, as I remember, it was. I mean, there's been some discussion about this lately, but my memory it tells me, and as you can tell, I, you know, my memory is pretty clear. I remember it as being in 3/4 time. Here, who's tripping down the streets of the city, you know, in 3/4. And I said, wow, if we could put that in 4/4, that would be great. And that's what we did. Gong, 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 gong.
Right.
You know, it's
a,
so
the rest is history.
The rest is rock and roll history.
Never
My Love, you know, the wonderful thing about Never My Love is Clark Burrows, who was, and this guy didn't get enough credit for what he did in music. Clark Burrows, who was the lead singer for the Hi-Lows, I'd met him when I recorded the Hi-Lows, a wonderful vocal group, had done an arrangement for them on one of their albums, and they said, you know who does good vocal arrangements is Clark Burrows. I said, I didn't know he was doing, you know, pop music. He said, oh yeah, you know, he's living out in the valley, and he got married, and blah, blah, blah. So I said, well, I'd love to talk to him. So I talked to him. I said, look, if you know how to voice these guys so that we can get some really hip harmonies out of them, I'd love for you to do this record. So he did, and when the Edrisis played me Never My Love, I said to him, you know, this is a wonderful ballad, but you know, I don't want to put a guitar solo in the middle of it. I don't want to put a saxophone solo, and every record's got a guitar solo, saxophone. You know, what I want to put is a vocal solo. I want you to write, you know, a vocal part that they can sing that's got no words, that's, you know,
a cantata,
you know, that's, and
yeah.
He wrote that piece, and it, to, you know, I still get shivers when I hear that. I mean, and they sang the pants off it. They, I mean, that piece, I mean, they sang on all their records, and that piece really shows you that those guys, when you could get them all lined up in the same direction, could really sing.
That's great. They turned down MacArthur Park, right?
Oh, gosh, yes. And Jimmy and I had done the Magic Garden album together with the Fifth Dimension. And, you know, we'd become good friends. And Jimmy, and we were finishing the Magic Garden album. Jimmy kept saying to me, I got an idea for the association. I want to do a tune for the association. I got an idea for a cantata. They're going to sing this cantata. I mean, of course, you know, Never My Love had come out, and by then everybody, you know, they say, well, they can really sing. And so I took Jimmy over to meet with him. We were in Studio 3 at Western. He sat down at the piano, which is what he always did, and he sang this six tunes in a row, which was going to be one side of an LP, which was, in those days, an innovation. Nobody did one whole side of an LP. I mean, we got into that in the 70s, but it wasn't really happening in the 60s, particularly that early in the 60s. And so he sang this whole thing, and there were, you know, one part of it had, Where's the Playground, Susie, was one of the tunes that he recorded with somebody else, and it was one of the tunes that was in this was one of the forerunners of Where's the Playground. But it ended with MacArthur Park. And the guys said, you know, we want to talk about this. Jimmy, would you go out and wait in the hall? So Jim went out in the hall, and we got into this massive discussion, and it ended up with them saying, any two guys in the association can write a better piece of music than that.
Wow.
And so they turned it down, and I was furious. You know, I tried to quit. They wouldn't let me. I just said, you know, you guys are making a huge mistake. But anyway, they did. We went on and did another album with them, and which wasn't, you know, it's called Birthday. It wasn't particularly a great album, and they chose most of the songs, and it was just it was a nightmare making the record, because by then they'd had enough success that they were really you know, musical geniuses, and so I was in New York doing vocals with the Fifth Dimension for the Stone Soul Picnic album, and I went down Sunday night to get Billboard magazine, and I opened Billboard magazine, and MacArthur Park was with Richard Harris was number one, and I called my lawyer and said, you know, call Warner Brothers and tell them I quit. I'm not doing anything more with that group of guys. And that's how that ended.
That's great. The Fifth Dimension, Johnny Rivers started a record label. Somehow he found the Fifth Dimension, and light bulb goes off over his head, the Black Mamas and the Papas.
That's exactly right.
And
he calls me on the phone and says, I want you to engineer this record. You know, I want to cover...
go where you want to go.
Yeah, I want to cover you. You got to go where you want to go. He said, I've talked to Lou, and Lou's not going to put it out as a single, so I'm going to cover that record, and I want it to sound just like that, and I want you to get the same musicians that played on that, and their arranger will help with the vocal arrangement. He'll write it out and rehearse them. So I said, fine. So, you know, Rivers and I went in the studio with him, and we recorded You Gotta Go Where You Wanna Go, and the record got on the chart. And everybody thought that it was a Sloan Berry song. It was like a, you know, folk rock song, and everybody thought they were white.
Hmm.
So then the word leaked out, and the next record they put out was Go Where You Want to Go was John Phillips. The next record was Another Day, Another Heartache, which was a Sloan Berry song. But by then, everybody knew that they were a black group, and somehow black and folk rock didn't go together. So that record wasn't very successful. And then John started working on an album with Jimmy Webb, who he just signed as a songwriter, and one of the tunes was Up, Up, and Away. And so I went in with John and did the Up, Up, and Away record, which I had promised I would do with him. So we did that in 1967. It was the last record I engineered for anybody else. And the record was successful, and Up, Up, and Away started getting played on WNEW in the greatest city in the world, where you are right now. It caught on there, and then pretty soon people were covering it. He was smart. Rivers was smart. He got singles out there and got heavy independent promotion, got people out there to work the record, the balloon. It was called the balloon. Everybody called it the balloon record, and it got into the top 10, and so they were launched.
Won 5 Grammys, I believe, for you.
I was just the engineer on that record, John. You know, but when I'd gotten 2 number one records with the Association, and he was getting busy with his own career, he called me up and said, "If you want to produce the Fifth Dimension, I want you to do it." And so I went in, and you know, we started doing what we did. We got going. Finally, I found Stone Soul Picnic, Laura Nero's tune, and that really got them an R&B hit, which they always wanted. And I think from that point on, we really got going.
Yeah, some amazing stuff. 1968, you do the comeback special with Elvis Presley. And we just heard Little Less Conversation, which has recently sort of been, it's everywhere now. It's an amazing track, that record. Were those songs recorded in a studio for him to sing along with in the show?
Yeah, some of them he sang, everything that he sang on camera, he sang live.
But the music was
the tracks were pre-recorded. Working in television, you work with not only, especially NBC, you work with not only pre-recorded tracks, but you work with the NBC studio orchestra, which we augmented with the Wrecking Crew, you know, rhythm section. But Steve Binder and I had started a company that we wanted to do both television work and record work, and we thought maybe I could be a contribution to the music part if we did musical television specials. And then I would do records, and we would find artists together and so on. The real highlight of that was we got called to NBC to discuss doing a Christmas television special with Elvis. And the Colonel had made a deal for Elvis to sing 24 Christmas songs, say Merry Christmas, everybody, and that was going to be it. And so we went out to talk to the executive producer, Bob Finkel, and we came back from that meeting, and I said, driving back to Steve, I said, you know, it's a shame. Steve said he's never been seen on TV the way he really is, you know, the way he really sings. And I said, well, you know, Steve, The way to do that is not to talk to the Colonel. The way to do that is to talk to Elvis, because he always produced his own records in the studio. And if we've got him fired up about doing that, he'll convince the Colonel. And that's exactly what happened. We managed to get a half-hour meeting with Elvis before the next meeting at NBC, and we pitched this idea to him. And I think the thing that really did it was Binder was so smart, he said he knew that Elvis had gotten into karate, and he said, you know, I know a choreographer who will choreograph a karate scene with you doing karate moves. And that was his eyes lit up, and that was it. And so we did the special. He was there in our office every day working on the script with the writers. He, you know, he was a trooper. He loved the process. He loved the process. He loved to perform. Now we're talking 1968. The music had really changed, and the Beatles had been around, and the Rolling Stones had been around. And if you look at the live section, this I tell everybody this. You know, everybody, Elvis was great. This, I said, take a look at that, at the live section. It's on a DVD now. It was on tape then. It's on a DVD now. He reaches for that microphone, and his hand is shaking at the beginning of the first tune. And he sang 8 bars, and he knew he had them. And Steve, that's one of the. And Steve, you know, started as a television director, doing Stars of Jazz. It was all live TV. You didn't get a second shot at anything. You know, you just called cameras, and if you were right, you were right, and if you were wrong, everybody knew it. So, but he called that whole thing live. I was in the booth. He called all those cameras live. And there's wonderful shots. My favorite shot in that whole thing is he superimposed a shot of a girl's face looking up at Elvis, and then Elvis swings his arm around and he wiped the girl's face. It was just amazing, amazing stuff that happens live in that live sequence. It's just... it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah,
we had
really
a great
exciting.
Time doing it.
It's a really exciting thing to watch. We're sort of running out of time, and I have, like, we're only about halfway through your career. It's because your career. So let me, a few quick things. Did you play drums on Grassroots Records?
I did.
Which ones?
I played on Where Were You When I Needed You. Let's see.
They just needed somebody, and...
What happened? No. What happened was I started playing on Sloan and Barry's demos, because Hal, of course, was so busy, they couldn't get him. And Jimmy Gordon had played on a few, but everything was really kind of going. This, we're talking mid-60s now. Everybody was busy. And I had played on a few demos, and they called me up and said, you know, you got to play on these demo sessions for us. And they did them in the morning, and most of my work was usually in the afternoon and the evening. So I said, okay, I'll play on a couple of them for you. So, you know, we've got to get this stuff down on tape. So I can't remember. We did a bunch of tunes, and one of them was Where Were You When I Needed You, and it was just a demo, and Phil sang on it. So it, you know, they took it to the Grassroots. They said, yeah, we're going to do the tune. They went in the studio to record it, and they could never get that same. It's really not a drum part because it's not exactly perfect rhythm. It's more like a percussion part. You know, it's got a lot of, you know, I have this really deep tom-tom I was hitting and all this other stuff, you know, they said they could never get the Grassroots to play that with that same feel. So they put the Grassroots voices on the demo that I played on. That's how I got on there.
I see. Yep.
And that's what happened with the rest of them. I just, you know, I went in the studio with Phil and Joe Osborne and, you know, whoever the guitar players were. And Phil played guitar on most of them. I mean, usually there were just maybe three or four of us in the studio. I played on the demos, and then they used, there's a song called Tip of My Tongue, which was a minor hit. It's just a bunch of stuff, and then I played on Phil's album. You know, Phil Sloan had for a while was known as P.F. Sloan.
Right, made some great records.
Folk rock records. So Hal played on some of those, and I played on some of them. So I was working around the studio. I just got so busy that I had made a decision. I had to do one thing, and it was decided that I would, you know, I decided I was going to produce, and that kind of ended all that.
All right.
But I'm shaking tambourine on Never My Love, and I'm on a lot of those records, someplace or other.
Okay, we've got. I'm sorry, I just have another guest coming, so it's
good. Well, I don't want to take up the other guest's time.
Wish we could. Well, we may have to do this again because you had quite a career after that. We didn't get to Tom Waits and the Monkees and Diana Ross, Phil Spector, a lot of other folks you've worked with and crossed paths with. I want to end this with maybe your biggest. You know, I was trying to think of a lot of times I'll introduce a guest. I'll say this guy had 13 number one hits or sold 500,000 records, and I think for you, it's the guy who maybe the audience name recognition is the least, but their ear recognition is the most. I would say of any guest I've had, I guarantee everyone listening has heard a song that you were there when was made. I mean, it's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, let me tell you one other thing that I really love. There's a site on iTunes called 60s Pop and Aquarius is number one.
Wow.
I don't know if it still is, but it was for a while. So I just, you know, there's some justice for getting old, you know.
I'm going to play this record, and it's an amazing, amazing record. The Fifth Dimension, Aquarius, Let the Sunshine. Actually, Galt McDermott is going to be on the show in a few weeks. Tell me how you found the song, how you put it all together, a little bit about the recording.
Well, it's a quick story. What happened was the Fifth were performing at the Americana Hotel. I can't remember what it's called now, but there was a hotel in New York called the Americana, and they used to perform in the showroom there all the time. And they were performing, and they called me up and said, "We went to see this show called Hair, and there's a great song in it for would just be great for us, called Aquarius, and we want to do it." And I said, "Well, okay, I'll go out and get the soundtrack album, but in the meantime." You know, I'm coming to New York to do vocals. We're working on a Stone Soul Picnic album. I'm coming to New York to do vocals with you guys, and when I get there, I'll go see the show. And I listened to the song, Aquarius, and I said, well, you know, it's not really a whole song. It's just sort of an introduction to the show. And, of course, when I saw the show, I realized that it just kind of goes from there into the show. And so I'm sitting there going, what am I going to tell them? You know, I don't know what I'm going to tell them. And then Ragney comes swinging across the audience, and they do this tune called The Flesh Failures. And the last three bars of The Flesh Failures is Let the Sunshine In, The Sunshine, The Sunshine In, you know. And I said, that's it. That becomes the last part. We make a medley, and we just put that in the end. So I call the publisher, because it's a Broadway show. You can't just do things like that to Broadway show tune. So I called the publisher and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to do Aquarius, and then I want to segue into Let the Sunshine In. And he said, what's that? And I said, well, it's the last three bars of The Flesh Failures, but you got to speak to, you know, Galt McDermott and, you know, the guys, Rado and Raggy, and ask them if they mind if I just, you know, use that last three bars and I'll make a medley. They'll have the whole thing, but it'll be actually two of their songs. And he said, okay, you know, I'll ask him. And so he called me back a couple of days later, and he said, yeah, he says you can do it. You know, he doesn't understand what you're going to do, but he says he doesn't mind if you'll make a record with the Fifth Dimension. He thinks that's great. So I made the record, and, of course, you know, it's rock history. It was number one for 8 weeks in a row. And later somebody said to me, gee, you know, I talked to this guy. The guy was the publisher. That was a great idea he had to put those tunes together. So everybody, you know, when you have a hit record, everybody thought of it. And, you know, he's welcome to it for whatever.
But it was your idea to hook those two things together.
Yes, it was.
I mean, and did they play it all the way through, or was it
I mean, I worked
edited.
The arrangement out. You know, how could he take credit for that? You know, I worked the whole thing out, figured out how we were going to do it, and Alcivar and I, you know, figured out how the vocal was going to go, and... You know, that's how it got done. But Bill Holman did the chart for the strings and horns, like he always did for me. Wonderful arranger whose jazz arrangements are now in the Smithsonian Institute.
And it's Joe Osborne on the bass and Hal.
That's Joe and Hal. Yeah, that's the guys. Tedesco. You know, it's all Tommy and Joe and Hal, the Wrecking Crew.
Well, it's a crazy record. Bones, Hal, thank you for joining us today.
It has
been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
I feel like we just scratched the surface. We may have to do this again.
Okay.
Because there's more to talk about.
Okay, now you can do 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 dee do 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 dee do do do.
Thank you, Bones.
Bye, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Cause it can't